From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
10 years after Arkansas last carried out an execution, the state has obtained new lethal injection drugs and could begin scheduling as soon as next week.
A federal judge gives final approval to a settlement over environmental damages stemming from the Mayflower oil spill.
Some Little Rock teachers are reeling because they may lose some long-protected negotiating powers.
Arkansas's uninsured rate dropped more than any other state in the nation since the Affordable Care Act went into effect. But that number could soon go back up.
Following a Fox News debate, Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz tries to make inroads in Mike Huckabee's Arkansas.
And a campaign is being launched to fund renovation work at the home of an Arkansas civil rights pioneer.
I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
That's all coming up on this week's KUAR Weekend Review Podcast. Men sit on Arkansas's death row today. It's been years since an execution was carried out. In fact, 10 years. Governor Mike Beebe attempted to schedule an execution a couple of years ago, but a court challenge halted that. There has also been a shortage in the drugs needed to actually carry out a lethal injection. Pharmaceutical companies, mostly from Europe, who were opposed to their product being used to put people to death, had objected to that use. But the Department of Correction, we learned this week, has secured the drugs that would be needed to put someone to death. And Jacob, you spoke with the governor who said the state could begin scheduling executions as early as next week.
There was no formal announcement coming from the governor's office about this, but there was news early in the week, as you mentioned, about those three drugs being purchased, and one of them is a controversial sedative that was used in a very troublesome execution in Oklahoma some time back that the U.S. Supreme Court later validated and said you can continue to use those drugs, of course, if you use them appropriately. But Governor Hutchinson met with a handful of reporters in his office earlier this week, and he said he's been in talks with the Attorney General's office, another Republican, Leslie Rutledge, and he expects to get a request from her office where it has to come from to start scheduling execution dates.
I expect, you know, in the coming week or so, one or more requests for dates to be set. I couldn't tell you which cases they are, but the indications are there's one or more that is in an appropriate setting to have a date set for execution.
And the governor said, in terms of what his actual timeline for be for what dates he might set, he said once he gets the request, he will set dates fairly quickly, but he's not sure on the actual timeline. And throughout this, he emphasized he expects there to be more legal challenges, as there has been in the past, so it'll be a lengthy process perhaps. But the governor was also asked by Talk Business and Politics reporter Steve Brauner how he might feel on the night of an execution, how that might weigh on his soul.
Now, I've been in law enforcement a long time, but I haven't thought about that, and I think it's a serious thing. My objectives in life, in terms of these type of cases, is that you assure that the system works, that innocence is protected. When guilt is established and the system works and it is reviewed and they have competent counsel, then it's my responsibility to carry out the law. We're not there yet, so I don't think you get too, you just simply do your duty until you get to that moment and you address it then. But like I said, unless the chief executive of the state sets dates, takes action, then the process will never move, and that's my responsibility.
Well, clearly the governor sounds slightly uncomfortable, and this is a former prosecutor. I don't know if he ever handled any death penalty cases, but this was sort of similar to the reaction when I asked Governor Beebe a couple of years ago how he felt scheduling an execution, and he said it's not something anyone takes lightly, but it's the law. It's what juries have determined the sentence should be. But Yes, Hutchinson, it sounded like he was a little awkward there.
A little bit. Maybe he was a little bit surprised to be asked that question, but it's certainly something I imagine he'll be thinking about more as it gets closer to that time. But his main argument was that he seems to believe the system does work and it is fair in terms of sentencing and punishment. Of course, there's lots of objections around the country right now about how justice is meted out based on different things like race and income. But the governor seems pretty confident in Arkansas's jury's decisions on all this. And the legislature helped enable this to happen last spring when they passed a law that allowed the suppliers of these drugs that will be used in lethal injection to keep that a secret from the public so that to avoid any protests. Because in the past, a lot of drug companies, particularly in Europe, have decided to stop producing this drug for lethal injection because of the association with their company.
Well, it's interesting because there for several years in the mid-90s, I covered every execution that Arkansas carried out, and they were having them at very regular intervals, and not just one inmate. They were having multiple executions, double or triple executions, where they would bring in inmates at one-hour intervals, put them to death. An hour later, they would, after clearing out the chamber, they would bring in the next inmate. They were typically inmates who had been involved in the same crime, but it seemed like there was no problem with this.
And it's interesting that act that you mentioned that was passed by the legislature that would prevent the disclosure of the supplier of the drugs, it's now involved in a lawsuit. I think criminal defense attorney Jeff Rosenzweig is also representing several death row inmates challenging that lawsuit, or challenging that law, saying that it conflicts with an earlier settlement from a previous lawsuit where the state had settled with these death row inmates and basically agreed that they would not prevent always reveal the supplier of the drugs. So, you know, I have read that Rosenzweig and those inmates may be going to court within the next month or so.
The governor mentioned in specifically that lawsuit that he expects there will be, that he knows that there's a challenge out there about that law, about the suppliers of the drugs, and he expects that the attorney general's office will be able to beat that challenge. But this announcement came, you know, just to show you a little bit of the difference in how the country feels about the death penalty. It came in the same week that Connecticut's court decided that the death penalty in that state was unconstitutional.
Well, nearly 2.5 years after an oil spill really shocked central Arkansas, you had the Pegasus pipeline in Mayflower rupture, a seam along the pipeline split, and you had hundreds of thousands of gallons of raw crude that suddenly started springing up through the ground through a rather affluent neighborhood in Mayflower. A lot of residents didn't even know the pipeline was there. But this really got concern from Central Arkansas Water, because this pipeline also runs through the Lake Maumelle watershed, the primary source of drinking water for Central Arkansas, for about 200,000 people. Well, Chris, this week, a settlement between the federal government, the state of Arkansas, and ExxonMobil was finalized, and this after a lawsuit had been filed against the pipeline company over environmental violations arising from the spill. You talked with several of the parties involved here.
Yeah, so the state of Arkansas, the U.S. Justice Department, and ExxonMobil had proposed this quote-unquote consent decree, which was basically a settlement over these environmental damages, environmental violations, violating the Clean Water Act. And this week, Judge Christine Baker in Little Rock, or in Arkansas District Court, ruled that this consent decree was fair, adequate, and reasonable, and consistent with the Clean Water Act. Basically, what it does a few things. It requires Exxon to meet the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration regulations regarding the treatment of a northern segment of the pipeline that's susceptible to seam failure, which basically means that they have to address any faulty welds in the pipeline that are, you know, could be burst with high pressure, as was the case in Mayflower.
Yeah, or were produced during the same time and have potentially the same flaws as the section that ruptured in Mayflower.
Right, right. And Exxon also has to train some of its employees in emergency response for similar type spills where they occur, and they have to establish different caches of emergency response equipment and oil spill equipment along the pipeline route. But the main part of it is a number of federal or in-state penalties and fines. Exxon has to pay about $5 million in fines, $1 million of which is state civil penalties, and that's one of the highest dollar amounts for any state civil penalty that has been required of an entity to pay over environmental damages. But what's not part of this deal is that Exxon does not have to remove a section of the pipeline going through the Lake Maumelle watershed, which supplies drinking water to most of this region, about 400,000 people. And I spoke with John Tynan, a public affairs director over at Central Arkansas Water. He's been the main critic of this consent decree and has written letters to Judge Baker and all parties, highly critical of this deal.
Obviously, Central Arkansas Water had hoped for a different outcome through this process. We had asked the judge either to reject the settlement and ask the parties to try and negotiate one that has more protections for the citizens of Arkansas, or at the very least delay it until there was some assurance that we will get some integrity improvement through the PHMSA-related process. Our opposition to the settlement was just one of many paths that we're pursuing to try and protect the Lake Maumelle watershed from the risks posed by the Pegasus pipeline.
Now, that PHMSA-related process that he mentions, PHMSA, the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, had found that Exxon had 9 probable safety violations in regards to the pipeline and had proposed fines of $2.6 million. And Exxon has appealed that, and we're awaiting a hearing determining that. And also, PHMSA had required a remedial work plan for fixing or addressing the section of the pipeline that's now closed, which is the northern section of the pipeline, basically from Texas through Arkansas on up until Illinois. Exxon had submitted a remedial work plan to fix that or to address the seam failure problems, and PHMSA found that inadequate, and that's kind of what Central Arkansas Water was hoping would be resolved, because they don't really have a lot of confidence in the federal agency's ability to enforce those regulations based on what they've determined were problems leading up in the years leading up to this pipeline rupture. But I also talked with a spokesman from ExxonMobil, Richard Kyle.
We appreciate final resolution on this matter and acceptance of the terms of the settlement, which was mutually agreed to by the U.S. Department of Justice, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and the state of Arkansas. As the court held, the consent decree is fair, adequate, reasonable, and consistent with the Clean Water Act.
Now, that's basically kind of the sentiment of most of the parties involved. Attorney General Leslie Rutledge sent out a statement. While certainly not perfect, the settlement secured a state civil penalty of $1 million, a historic dollar amount for an Arkansas settlement regarding air and water violations. And she went on to praise the rest of it. And the U.S. Justice Department said similar things. Basically, none of the parties really agreed with Central Arkansas Water that removal of the pipeline from the watershed should be a main concern.
And at this point, the pipeline has not been put back in service, at least in this section through Arkansas.
Yeah, there part of the pipeline through Texas has been restarted, but it looks increasingly likely that it will restart. It's uncertain when. It's been mentioned in some reports that it could be a year or two, but it all kind of depends on what that administrative process with PHMSA and Exxon submitting a remedial work plan to meet their regulations will look like and whether or not they can carry them out. So.
It's interesting to me, you mentioned earlier some of the antiquated welding technology that's in hundreds of miles of this pipeline that led to that, according to PHMSA, that tear in Mayflower. That there's been a lot of debate over things like Keystone XL, that pipeline, that it might pose dangers to the environment. And that I've heard Tim Griffin say, is you know, it's leaps and bounds different. It's like a totally different technologies that are being used. And the fine, Attorney General Leslie Rutledge said it was one of the biggest fines ever. Dustin McDaniel, the previous Attorney General, started that case. But really, for ExxonMobil, it's a drop in the bucket.
This week, representatives of the Little Rock School District met with leaders of the teachers' union. And, Sarah, there are a lot of concerns. Protections that have essentially been in place for about half a century are now being threatened. Some changes are being considered. You've talked with a lot of those involved. What's happening here?
Teachers in the Little Rock School District learned this week that their union representatives had been negotiating with district leadership about new contract with the union. And the new contract that the district has proposed most recently involves significant cuts to the negotiating powers of the union. So it reserves the union reserves the right to negotiate on salary and benefit issues. There are other sort of policy issues, matters of teachers' sort of say in how their day goes, and other educational issues that are at stake in a much longer 93-page contract that has been developed over the course of decades in negotiations between the district, but hasn't largely been changed. So a former school board member, Jim Ross, who's a great critic of the state decision to take over the district last winter, published some documents, information he got from documents that he FOIA'd, sort of revealing the existence of this negotiating plan. And so the teachers union then met with its members to openly discuss, you know, what they had been in negotiating with the district. Both sides have emphasized that this is one proposal in a negotiation process that's being talked about now. Baker Kurz has a business person's background. So, you know, one of the fundamental changes that's occurred is because the state took over the district, the union can no longer have certain rights that it had in relation to the district legally because it's now essentially negotiating with the state. And a Supreme Court ruling about the Pulaski County Special School District 2 years ago found that in that instance, when a similar change happened in terms of the union's negotiating powers with the state takeover, the Supreme Court ruled that the union didn't have certain rights that it had previously. So I spoke with Kathy Kohler, the leader of the Little Rock Education Association, before she met with her members, and she said that what's really important to them, over 90% of the members say their priority is to maintain full health care insurance coverage, and that was her real goal in this negotiation. She thinks that's still possible if things don't get out of hand with the districts, with conversation with the district, and that's what she really wants to emphasize to her members.
And financially, their number one priority, well over 90% of the employees who have been surveyed have responded, is to have fully funded or as close to it health care insurance premium.
So as she said, the district is made an offer and the union can make a counter offer.
There's a lot that we have not been able to share and had been trying to work through this in a way that created the least confusion. Unfortunately, that was taken away from us. And so now what we're trying to do is to get the members all of the information, much of which has not been made public, and allow them to decide how as an association we proceed.
The union had previously been a great advocate for Jim Ross in his election to the school board campaign, and he obviously was not satisfied with some of the terms of the deal that he learned were going on, so he kind of stepped in and interrupted the process, I guess, to her.
Yeah, and I know that the superintendent said in a statement that he wasn't going to debate this on a blog or on social media, that he didn't feel that's the way to approach this. But what has the district essentially been saying about why this change is needed?
Well, the district has the challenge of compensating for the loss of around $38 million in funds that it would have previously gotten through desegregation money, and that's by the 2017-2018 school year. So a lot of cuts and planning have been centered around that, in addition to the need for significant facilities updates. The district's crunching numbers, and then it has, of course, the six schools in academic distress. So Baker Kurris has been talking since he started as superintendent about doing this overhaul of the district, and everyone's been on notice that things financially are going to change.
And some of the frustrations from the ex-board members, more than Jim Ross, still the majority of the board, they've had meetings throughout the summer with, attended by up to 100 people, some of them in Southwest Little Rock. And John Walker, who's been a prominent lawyer for minority students in the district for a long time, one of their main concerns about this is the idea of state control was because there are a few schools in academic distress in the district. And so all along they've been saying that this state takeover is more than about correcting academic distress in those few instances. And so they'll see this as another example of the state tackling fiscal issues and other issues such as teacher bargaining power and the right to unionize. And they'd say that's maybe an abuse of the reason why the state said they're going to take over for academic distress. And while Baker Kurris does not want to have the debate on social media, it does not mean that it is not happening there. State Senator Joyce Elliott, who's a retired teacher, a fierce advocate for the Little Rock Education Association, questioned why there aren't attacks on other organizations of professions, such as business leaders, she mentioned, and any chamber of commerce. It's acceptable for them to get together to organize for a principal. So she kind of questions why teachers are singularly kind of attacked for trying to represent themselves in this way. But so there is that conspiracy all along, though, that the state wanted to do more than just fix academic distress. They had a lot more objectives on their mind. And for some of those people who believed in that, initially, this would be confirmation to them.
Baker Kurris announced to the state board last night that he is not going to prioritize building a school in West Little Rock, and that was one of the most contentious issues for the school board before it was disbanded, because that's a more traditionally white upper-class part of town. And so one of the biggest, most contentious questions was, newly elected school board members wanted schools built in lower income, more diverse neighborhoods. And then Leslie Fiskin, other board members were advocates of pushing for this West Little Rock school first, or at least having an agreement that would be the priority in a building plan. So I don't know that if Superintendent Kurris's statement today was a concession in any way to some of his critics about what his priorities are. This is a part of what's happening now. There's a sea change in education in Arkansas with the Walton Family Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, working with the state board to overhaul education in this state. And then, of course, some other issues came up in state board meetings this week revolving around legislation passed by a Democrat, Reginald Murdoch, that would have allowed public schools to waive certain standards for education that charter schools are allowed. So it seems that both standards and the union's role and the influence of various foundations and outside groups are shifting powers in education and shifting standards all around, and the state taking over the district has happened in the midst of all that. And it is a confusing situation to identify what changes are coming from where and what the real impetus is.
Certainly a different end to the summer for teachers than at the beginning, where Superintendent Kurris gave them a $350 bonus, saying how much he appreciated them. Now we're at the end of the summer, and they might be losing some of their rights to negotiate their benefits.
Yeah, of course, the end of last year, Kurris did acknowledge that teachers have not asked for funding increases in their contracts in the past year out of consideration of the desegregation funding issues. And it seemed that he was working quite closely with the union leadership. And, who knows what kind of realities they're reckoning with given the limitations of their power under the state control.
And on changes to the contract, do we know when those might be finalized?
I don't. As I spoke with Kathy Kohler, she certainly didn't expect this information to come to light. So this is a private process. She says it's never happened before in her tenure that private negotiations with the district were publicized before they were finished. And so I think that they're hoping to regain that private status of this process.
Well, on to another topic. Jacob, last week in the podcast, we talked about the fact that up to 50,000 people could be dropped from Arkansas Medicaid or private option roles. And this week, we had a survey that came out by Gallup that shows Arkansas has cut its uninsured rate by more than half since the first revisions of the Affordable Care Act went into effect in 2013.
The criticism all along has been that the Affordable Care Act might cause people to lose their coverage, might be able to lose their doctor. But in Arkansas, at least, the effects have been pretty dramatic. We had a 22.5% uninsured rate in 2013 before most of the Affordable Care Act kicked in. Now it's down to 9.1%. And this time last year, Arkansas also led the nation along with Kentucky, dropping that 22.5% to around 12.5%. And Arkansas yet again has continued to lower that uninsurance rate, still number one in the country for reducing that. And that's well below the national average. It went from 17.3% to just over 11% since the Affordable Care Act. This Gallup survey, their analysis shows that states that have chosen to implement as many parts of the Affordable Care Act as they could, things like Medicaid expansion, which turned out to be the private option in Arkansas, or like state-based marketplaces, that those states have done much better in reducing their uninsured rates. So you can compare Arkansas, which had a 22.5%, now it's down to 9%. Texas right now, their uninsured rate is over 20%. And that's a state, like most southern states, that has chosen not to expand Medicaid or implement much of the Affordable Care Act. But I spoke with Jim Hendren, who is a governor's nephew. He's the Senate Majority Leader, and he also chairs the Medicaid Task Force that by the end of this year or next year is supposed to have a set of recommendations about what Arkansas's health care plan is going to really look like. He said, of course, it's good for more people to be insured. But he said that number probably will go back up, as you mentioned, because of the Medicaid terminations. And he kind of questioned, well, just because more people are insured doesn't mean we have good health care policy. More money equals more coverage, but there could be other ways to do it.
It's very possible it could. But I've said all along that, look, you spend $100 million a month on insurance premiums, you're going to make a dent in a state the size of Arkansas on the number of uninsured. That's mathematics, and nobody can dispute that. And that's a good thing. The question is, how do we sustain it? Is it sustainable? Is it the best and most efficient way to deliver health care to those folks? That's what the task force is trying to determine. So are those numbers, and again, it's mathematics. If we end up redetermining and 40 to 60,000 people roll off of that, do I expect it to tick up? The math says it will.
And that's a much different reaction than the Beebe administration. Back when the first Gallup poll came out mid-year through 2014, they were hailing it as a great success, as proof of their wisdom in passing the private option. No response from the Hutchinson administration, at least. Obviously, Senator Hendren commented on it when I asked him about it, but totally different response.
And last week, as we learned all these people were set to lose coverage, Governor Hutchinson imposed a two-week moratorium or pause on sending out the letters. And as we discussed, more employees are being shifted into the roles of taking in letters from people who are applying for coverage. So I'm assuming that period will end next week. Do we know anything yet? What's going to happen then?
It's a little unclear. I had the opportunity to ask someone in the governor's office two times this week if Tuesday or Wednesday is, in fact, when that two-week hiatus ends. And they said they weren't exactly sure about that, but sometime next week it looks likely. We're not sure what will come out of it. The income verification letters have continued to go out during this time, even though the termination notices have been on pause. So we'll see if DHS has the expanded capacity to help deal with some of this so that if people are sending in information, at the very least, DHS will have time to process it before they send out termination notices. But, I mean, this story will continue, I think, for another month or two. At the end of August, about 13,000 people at this point are set to lose Medicaid coverage.
Well, this week we had another Republican presidential candidate come through Arkansas. I guess this is the third. Ted Cruz came through Little Rock as well as Russellville and Van Buren on Wednesday. About a month ago or so, we had Donald Trump speaking to Republicans in Hot Springs. And we also, of course, had former Governor Mike Huckabee make his campaign announcement here. But you covered the rally for Ted Cruz in Little Rock at the state Republican Party headquarters. What did he have to say?
Well, Senator Cruz wanted to emphasize that, you know, to really kind of excite the people that were there. Pretty good crowd, 300 or so people, very lively, lots of young people, lots of women there as well. He emphasized that Arkansas is now part of this SEC primary. So instead of our primary being towards the end of the primary calendar where almost no candidates would visit, the nomination would have probably already been decided, we're now going to be after Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, then Arkansas is one of 10 southern states in this so-called SEC primary. And so Senator Cruz tried to really rally people there. And this is all on the heels of that big Fox News debate, the first one that happened. And since then, Mike Huckabee's lost a lot of ground. Ted Cruz has picked up some ground, so he's hoping to make some inroads. Primarily, though, he focused on foreign policy. His remark that he used the strongest language in was about the Iran nuclear deal and President Obama.
If this deal goes through, the Obama administration will become the world's leading state financier of radical Islamic terrorism.
So that line probably drew the least amount of applause, actually, in the end. But that's something kind of new he's been saying, and it definitely struck a chord with people that stuck out. And the other thing he did, though, in particular with Obama and Iran, is that he compared the president to the former President Jimmy Carter's record. And it happened to be on the same day where Jimmy Carter announced that his liver cancer was spreading to other parts of his body. And Ted Cruz in the past made fun of Joe Biden's son just a few days after he died, and he apologized for that. So another kind of unseemly timing on this sort of issue.
You know, the one person in America thrilled with the job Barack Obama's doing is Jimmy Carter. Now, why does that analogy give me soap? That's pretty good.
Kind of hard to hear there, but someone in the audience in the crowd shouted out Jimmy Carter's senile. Ted Cruz said he thought that was funny. But in general, most of the people that were there, they're for Ted Cruz because they see him as someone who's anti-establishment, who's not like one of the other GOP leadership that's already elected in Washington, D.C. He's fought for budget shutdowns. He's fought against Planned Parenthood. He's frequently a critic, so much to the point that Republican leadership has ostracized him publicly. But I spoke with one woman, Merrill. I'll think of her last name in a minute. That was her sentiment. She was very excited. She drove from Conway with her family.
He's a fighter. He stands against the rhinos. And that's what I want, a man to stand against the establishment. I'm tired of establishment Republicans. We voted a bunch of Republicans in. What do? They play patty cake with Obama and his administration. I want no more patty cake. I want a man who stands. And Ted Cruz is a man to stand.
That was Merrill Fulmer, and I asked her what was the most egregious example of patty cake that's been played, and she rattled off about 8 different things.
I think that's a pretty good example of the anger that a lot of people have. If you're a Republican and you're not fighting with full guns against the president, then, yeah, I guess you're playing patty cake.
And Cruz has also been one of the only candidates to really say he supports everything that Donald Trump has been saying. So some residual support for that, maybe.
And we've mentioned that, you know, there was a poll last week that suggested Trump is leading Huckabee in Arkansas. Any comments like that? Is this date really, are any people really looking at this as a potential battleground for Republicans in the primary?
Well, everybody there that I talked to that supported Ted Cruz, and everyone there I spoke to was there for Ted Cruz and supported him, and that's why they went there. They said they also like Mike Huckabee a lot. No ill will for Mike Huckabee. Particularly, they like his stand on things like Planned Parenthood, religious liberties. So no real objections to Huckabee there. But it is notable that there are several state legislators, one of them who is behind the religious freedom law, Bob Ballinger from Hinesville. He's the co-chair of Ted Cruz's campaign in Arkansas. And he said he liked Huckabee as well. But he said he didn't think Huckabee will make it to the March 1st primary, that after Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, he might not be there. And he said this will be a Cruz state if that happens. And Ted Cruz is, of course, from Texas, so there are some similarities.
This week, the foundation that oversees the Daisy Bates House, which is where the Little Rock Nine coordinated efforts to integrate Central High School in the 1950s, announced a fundraising campaign. For $100 each, people can have their names and messages placed on a 4x8-inch brick, which will line the sidewalk leading to the home. Daisy Bates, she was head of the state NAACP at the time and really orchestrated the integration of Central. And it was at her home that the Little Rock Nine would often meet before going to school. It's also when you had long periods when the students were not allowed to go to class as the crisis played out, as then-Governor Orville Faubus brought out the National Guard to prevent the students from entering the high school. And then you had President Eisenhower respond by sending Army troops to enforce a court order that said they should be allowed to attend the school. This is where they gathered. It's also when they weren't able to go, they were tutored in the basement of the home. It's a ranch-style home, fairly modest, though, on 28th Street. But it's been designated, was about 14 years ago, a National Historic Site. And it's not open necessarily for regular hours for the public to visit. People can schedule tours. And it has been restored to the way it looked at the time in the 1950s, similar furnishings that look identical to the historic black and white photos you have of the era. And in particular, you really get a sense, standing inside the home, of the history there, in large part because when you're standing in the living room, there's a large picture window, and beside that is a black and white photo of Daisy Bates standing at that picture window. And outside on the front lawn, you've got the military jeeps lined up, military officers with weapons at the ready, waiting to take the children to Central. So they are hoping to do some work to restore the home. I covered the announcement that took place on Wednesday and spoke with Dale Charles. He's treasurer of the Museum Foundation Board, has also been head of the NAACP in Arkansas. And he spoke about how people still travel from around the world to see the school. They go over to the National Park Service Visitor Center where they can learn more about it. But then the home is also another link to the history of that. Here's what he had to say.
I think it was a great opportunity for people to be part of history with this commemorative sidewalk, because people are going to always come by to visit this house. And to see your name as a contributor to this, it adds volume as young people come all across the state, all across this country, and even out of this country to visit this house. They call and make tours, so when they come in, once we get this commemorative sidewalk laid, then they will see all these names, and it will add to the history that's already in this house. See, this is one of the most historical sites in Arkansas, because it was the command post for the 1957 Central High crisis, and that it was orchestrated through Miss Daisy Bates, was president of Arkansas State NAACP. And, you know, for a whole year, the one-on-one airborne would come in, pick these students up and take them to Central, bring them back. And then they would strategize how to keep going at night. And it was a terrible time in our history.
Anything in particular the money raised from this will go toward? I know there was still, I toured the house maybe a year or two ago with the National Park Service, and at that time the basement was closed. Any particular thing this is going to?
Yeah, we will be using some of the proceeds to do some work in the basement, and our hope is to get an executive director here so we can have it open full time, that anybody wants to come by, just give us a call and come by and visit this home and take a tour of it and help educate our young people and some of our adults that don't really know what really happened here and what all occurred and the tremendous sacrifice that the Little Rock Nine made along with their parents and this community and the base.
And indeed, you really do have people who, when they're traveling through Arkansas, especially of a certain generation, the first thing they think of when they think of Little Rock is the Little Rock Nine. And I've spoken to a lot of people like that. But Daisy Bates was something. I spoke with her, I interviewed her once about 21 years ago at the state capitol when she was being honored. I think it was maybe 95. She had had several strokes by that time and could barely speak. So it was disappointing to not be able to actually do much of an interview with her, but she was still, you know, her role in this and the danger that she took. The First Lady of Arkansas, Susan Hutchinson, is taking a lead role in this current effort, and I also spoke with her about this.
I was pleasantly surprised to be asked to be co-chair of the L.C. and Daisy Bates Foundation BRIC initiative to raise funds to make sure that the L.C. and Daisy Bates House continues on into the future to remind us of what happened here and how far we've come and what we can be doing today and in the future. It's important to remember that sometimes things were so tough and the sides were so against each other that if the men stepped forward, they would be killed or they would lose their business. But if their wives stepped forward, not so much. So the men would kind of stay in the background and encourage their wives to step forward and do these things. And that's my understanding here with Daisy Bates, that she was a strong woman and she and her husband were in agreement that this is what needed to be done. And so she played the role of being the front person on it, more of a protection and a shield to him. But they were still a team and committed to the righteousness of equality.
And in particular, Mrs. Hutchinson mentioned the history, the hatred. There was, at one point, the picture window I mentioned, a rock was thrown through the window, which had a note attached to it saying essentially, a rock this time, a bomb next time. So they really went into this knowing that they were taking some level of risk. There was also a cross burning in the front yard of this home. So the history there, they're really working to make sure that this particular location also gets the attention that the school itself gets.
I was wondering, Michael, as you went to the house, you're familiar with the area before. It's right down the road from Central, as you mentioned. What's that neighborhood like now, besides that house, which is obviously in good condition?
This is mostly the inner city. You know, the neighborhoods, other streets don't look at all like this. This was a pretty well-to-do neighborhood back in 1957. But, of course, as the population spreads out, it's declined, and now there's a lot of crime in the area.
Well, Michael, you mentioned the cross-burning and the rock and the other threats. I know Daisy Bates and her husband, L.C., ran a progressive newspaper, the State Press, which went out of business because of a boycott, and I had heard about the threats to her house. I wonder if, with the renovation, there'll be any highlighting of her work as a journalist and also some of those physical, some of the physical distress on the house itself when they repair it. What state will it be in?
Yeah, and because I mentioned, or I'm not sure if I did, but the basement at this point is closed to the public. That's the one section that if you do call and line up a tour, that's the one place they cannot take you into because of the condition down there. And Dale Charles did mention the fact that they did lose the State Press in this crisis, and that was a big disappointment to them. A lot of them really took a toll for their role in this crisis, but generally now respected as civil rights pioneers. Of course, you've got the Capitol, where you've got the statues of the Little Rock Nine. So it's an effort just to continue by them, nothing specific, but to continue to do work to expand what they do, in particular at the home. And a lot of people, while the Little Rock Nine get the attention, Mrs. Bates and her husband aren't always getting that same level of attention. But as I said, it was Mrs. Bates who actually pretty much organized this. Well, with that, we're done. I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I produced this week's episode. Our music is by Chris Hickey. KUAR is a service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. If you're not a subscriber to the podcast, we hope you'll go to iTunes and subscribe so you can catch our wrap-up each week. You can send any feedback to news@kuar.org. You can also find us online, kuar.org. Thanks for listening.